The Lions Sheriff of Jim Williams. And that's the only thing I thought I would want to know. And I don't think that is the case, so.
Star 1, UCC, what was that on Boylston Street?
Something just exploded at the finish line.
UCC, did I hear that correctly?
Yeah, see it. Confirm it. Two devices just went off at Boylston and Exeter.
Two devices just went off. Beautiful day. Everybody's enjoying the Boston Marathon. Runners are coming to the finish line, not realizing that catastrophe was fixing to strike. Two separate bombs go off, three killed instantly, 281 injured, 12 ultimately would lose arms or legs, just like that. And folks, we live in a dangerous world, and part of what we're about is helping you to protect your family, equipping you with the right information as to how to respond, because for all of us, this would be a nightmare, especially recognizing that at the finish line, there were many families waiting for their runners, their family members to cross the line. And so today I'm thrilled to again bring in a couple folks that are way smarter than me. Let me just say that for the record. We have Dr. Ben Feinzimmer, who is an incredible, experienced ER doc, fireman, and I'll let him tell you a little bit about himself. And also we have Dave Young from our team, which you all have met before. Dave is humble, but Dave has spent a very illustrious career, both as a police officer, FBI, and part of his role was with FBI SWAT. And so, unfortunately for Dave and I, we've been in situations where there's been numerous casualties, as has Doc. And Doc, I just want to say thank you. I know with your schedule that it's difficult to find time. So thank you for making time for us and for our audience, because we want to pick your brain. This is all about helping people know, hey, if I find myself in something like this, which, by the way, you kind of look recently at the numbers of mass casualty incidents. They're growing almost daily. We had one in Florida, Martin Luther King Day, 8 killed and lots of tragedy. So thank you for joining us, and tell everybody just a little bit about yourself, if you would.
Sure, Tim. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me. So I have kind of a varied background. Many, many, many years ago, I started my career as a fireman and EMT. Somewhere along the lines, got a master's degree in organizational psychology, and I still haven't figured out how to really use that. I ended up in medical school, and I think while, you know, many doctors and times I spent in the office setting, of course, that's necessary, I knew very early on that I don't have the attention span for office-based medicine, so lights and sirens are my drug, and I knew emergency medicine was the career path for me. So after residency in emergency medicine, I've worked both in Kenosha, and now I'm in the North Shore University Health System, which is a multiple hospital system north of Chicago. In both places, I've been fortunate enough to hold director positions as EMS and SWAT team medical director in Kenosha, and then down in North Shore as the EMS medical director out of Highland Park, which includes the Highland Park Fire Department. And of course, they were involved deeply in the shooting on July 4th. I've also been able to somehow stand up and get funding for a physician response vehicle. So as I mentioned, my passion is definitely being out in the field in pre-hospital medicine. So I get to live my best 16-year-old life and drive around with lights and sirens and hang out with the guys in the field, helping them with patient care at the point of injury or illness. So I've gotten to live my dream.
Thank you for what you do.
Sure, of course.
Thank you for what you do, because I'll tell you, you know, the on-scene folks in today's world, you know, that's a very different dynamic than when I think Dave and I started many years ago. You know, having experts like you there to save lives and be part of that whole development process is so important. And I know Dave and I have had a conversation. You've been friends with Dave for a long time, which I'm jealous. Let me just say that on the front end. Dave is a stellar guy, and we're so thankful to have him on the Lionheart team. But Doc, let me ask you, tragedy strikes, bombs go off, mass casualties. For the average person out there, what kind of advice would you give to them? What kinds of things do they need to think about if they ever, God forbid, if they ever find themselves in a situation like that?
Sure. Tim, I don't know how it is in law enforcement, but in the world of medicine, it's fascinating how things come full cycle. So many, many years ago, tourniquets were in. And then there was a period of time where tourniquets were deemed dangerous and they're out. And now they're back in. So, you know, there's this kind of constant search for what's right at the time, what's been used before, what has worked, what has not. So to answer your question, first of all, safety is your number one priority. And in the world of EMS, you can't pass any of your tests, your practicals, if you don't first say what's called BSI, scene safety. So that's wearing your gloves and your mask, but wow, scene safety. So no one can enter a scene until it's safe. Having said that, we know that these scenes that you're describing are inherently unsafe, and they never will be safe, at least for hours and hours and hours. As it applies to the person in the community, the lay provider, make sure you and your loved ones are as safe as possible. If you're talking about helping others and you can move someone, get them to a place of cover. Now, Dave can speak to this more accurately, what cover actually means. But the number one priority is getting them to a hospital as quickly as possible. And we can talk about more in depth what that means. Throwing them in the back of a car, a pickup truck, a wheelbarrow, that's totally acceptable. There's actually good data that supports the concept of speed above all else. So waiting for someone who's injured to get into an ambulance and go with a paramedic, actually, that might not be the best approach. So get them to the hospital as quickly as you can.
Wow.
Go ahead. Yeah.
No, that's really different than anything I've heard, which is awesome. Because I remember seeing that at the nightclub, the Pulse nightclub shooting, where there were so many victims, they were just throwing them in cars. So that's really interesting information. And why is that?
Because there are essentially two major injury pathways for these events. One where someone's going to die quickly, and one where someone's not going to die quickly. Now, that's not to say someone who gets shot or has shrapnel in their leg and has a broken femur doesn't need to be fixed. But the person who is injured in the chest or the belly, for instance, they need an operating room. Mm-hmm. No matter what we do in the field, no matter what interventions a paramedic can provide, they need an operating room.
Wow.
Nothing else equals survival. So getting them to the final destination where a surgeon can help them or an emergency room can stabilize them, that takes priority over everything else. Medicines.
That's CPR, totally fascinating.
Right.
So let me ask you real quickly before I shift over to Dave, what kinds of things can families do to prepare them before it ever happens? In other words, you know, what kind of training, what kind of stuff should they carry with them? Obviously you brought out tourniquets.
Sure.
The Stop the Bleed program is out there now. What kinds of things should families, it's no longer could, it should families do to prepare themselves for an event like this?
Right. So the thing that kills people in these violent events is bleeding. So however you can stop the bleeding, the number one intervention is pressure. And people think, oh, I'm just putting pressure on a hole and so I can't see it, but they're still bleeding. When in actuality, the physiology of the body, the blood vessels will clot and stop bleeding. They're pressure induced. So if you put a finger on a hole, you're actually engaging the body's clotting chemicals to help. And that goes from anything from a simple cut with a kitchen knife to to someone who's going to bleed to death from an injury to, say, their liver. So pressure is your number one priority. If you have a tourniquet, great. I think the majority of us don't carry tourniquets on our body, but someone somewhere might have a belt or a ripped shirt or anything that you can put on an extremity, arm or leg, to cinch off the bleeding. And then you think, oh, where do I have to put it? You don't have to think about that, actually. You put it as high as you can. So we use the term high or die. So even if someone has an injury on their forearm or their wrist and it's squirting blood and they're going to bleed to death, you just wrap that thing up around their bicep or up under their armpit. If someone's got a terrible injury near their knee and you're thinking, do I put it on, below the knee, above the knee, 2 inches above, where do I stick it? As high as you can go on the leg. So put it around the thigh and you cinch down as hard as you can. If they're screaming in pain, good. Then they're alive and you're saving their life. So as hot, as tight as you can, wow. You want all blood to stop. So pressure and that, tie something around an extremity. If you're bleeding from somewhere else, there's nothing you can do. They need an operating room.
Yeah, that goes back to your point about getting them into the car and getting them to the hospital as quickly as possible. Man, that's just golden sound advice that, quite frankly, a lot of people never think about.
Sure.
Dave, you've been on the law enforcement side, and the chaos of the medical injuries is one aspect people should think about. But as you pointed out before, what if the threat's still going on? You know, what kinds of things are law enforcement officers thinking as they're rolling into this?
Law enforcement is thinking the threat. How do I stop the threat? Or how do we stop the threat? That's going to be their first priority. And that's going to mean stepping over and past people who are injured in a variety of to a variety of extents. So their first priority is to stop the threat. And so, you know, if you come to a scene of a mass shooting, their first goal is to stop the threat, eliminate the threat. At that point, once they can verify that the threat has stopped, they can start attending to those who are injured. And trying to move those who are injured and start to get the process moving to get the people to the hospital. But law enforcement is always going to move to stop the threat, whether it's a school, a workplace, an outdoor venue. It's always the same. Stop the threat first.
So, Doc, let me come back to you, ping pong back. Now, you got this dynamic because you oversee emergency responders and you got law enforcement. Who wins? What should average people do?
Okay, so as Dave is explaining, the bad guy or bad guys or girls need to be stopped. They are going to have tunnel vision going toward that threat. So as a bystander, if you're reaching out, yeah, help, 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 which we all understand the desperation is overwhelming, you have to have an appreciation for what they need to do. Similarly, as the paramedics and EMTs come up, this is one of the hardest things that people have to deal with. You're sitting there beside someone who's bleeding to death and you're yelling, help, help, help. In mass casualty response, you have to do the most good for the most people with the fewest resources. So it is possible that a paramedic or even a police officer will look down and see this person, unfortunately, is not going to make it. Exhausting resources on that person is potentially risking the lives of 3, 4, 5 other people. So we, as the lay people, have to understand if someone is stepping over you, as Dave said, or bypassing or going to help other people, it's not because they devalue that person. It's because they're trying to save as many people as they can. I don't know if that really answers the question.
You know, Doc, this is,
yeah,
it does actually, because what if by doing what we're doing, people get motivated to go out and attend a Stop the Bleed course. They attend a CPR training. They take basic first aid and they begin to equip themselves. Wouldn't it be a great world if people didn't have to wait for paramedics to do what you just challenged them to do, which is to put pressure, to put on tourniquets and save lives? You're the expert, but I heard a time frame that if you hit an artery, it takes between 2 and 2 minutes, 30 seconds for you to bleed out. Is that true?
Absolutely, especially a large sized artery. So a groin, for instance, what's called a femoral artery or something in the armpit, you can absolutely bleed out in that time frame. And to your point, wouldn't it be great if more people were equipped? The answer is unequivocally yes. The accounts that I've heard from almost all of the individuals who responded to July 4th was the overwhelming and just hugely impressive response by the community. People who were willing to literally put their lives in danger, with the gunman not being apprehended, corralled, or even whereabouts known, yet putting themselves out and helping people. As the paramedics come up, they have to triage. And these people were asking, what should I do? The paramedic will say, put your finger there, put your hand there, help me with that one. Because you're right, two paramedics at first, maybe four, it's going to be another couple of minutes till two more show up. And an engine will come up maybe 3 minutes more. So you absolutely need all these hands available to do what you can do.
Such great counsel. It's such great counsel. And if people take this advice, they're going to be able maybe even to save their families. It may be their family members are the ones waiting for care. And Dave, let me ask you, at what point is law enforcement going to transition under the New World Order to any kind of medical care? I know the shooter or the person responsible now is no longer a threat. What kinds of training are police officers getting now? Because quite frankly, I see them walking around on their vest with a Cat 5 tourniquet. So when does that happen?
Most SWAT teams do engage in training that is tactical medicine. You know, cursory is probably the wrong word, but a basic level of tactical medical training in terms of tourniquets, as Ben mentioned, equipment that can be used to put pressure on and seal the chest seals, you know, front and back, possibly for entry and exit wounds and things of that nature. So street level law enforcement patrol officers on every level are starting to receive or have received that type of training as well. So we're seeing a lot more of that. So when the threat eventually is neutralized, or even before it's neutralized, and if we can free up officers who are responding to start attending to victims and moving them out of harm's way to positions of cover, we can start addressing those medical concerns. So I know it's alarming for people to hear that we're stepping over victims who are in need of life-saving measures, but they're depending, it's case specific. I can't say 100% of the time we're stepping over people until the threat is neutralized. That's just not the case.
Right.
It's very case dependent. So there may be a case where there's still danger, but we're able to free up people to move victims to a position of cover, which means cover is a barrier that will stop bullets.
Right.
Which is different from concealment, which may or may not.
Yeah. So hide you from them. Yeah.
Hides you from them. Right.
Yeah.
So
that's there a good word.
There is a transition point where we can start to provide some level, a low level, but a level nonetheless of medical intervention.
And Dave,
you know, what was interesting, Dave, when I went through Secret Service basic training, they were way more concerned about us being equipped medically to care for a protectee than they were at the time, you know, the bullets and the protection. Obviously, that's why they're there. But they found through experience that many more protectees suffered medical issues, and they wanted folks trained in that arena. It seems like that's where a lot of law enforcement's beginning to go, even with Stop the Bleed tactical application of tourniquets. And that's exciting because, as Doc, you pointed out, you get the tourniquet on high right away, and you're buying that valuable time that we need. And Doc, I wonder, you know, as you have been involved in these experiences, obviously we think of the gunshot wounds, we think of shrapnel, but what other injuries are consistent with an event like that that people may have to deal with?
Sure. So if it's a blast, you have what are called blast injuries, and depending on how close you are to the actual item, explosion, that could determine if your organs have sustained a pressure injury. So it's possible that you come upon someone who's the victim of an explosion, and they have no externally visible injuries. They're not bleeding, but they're hard to wake up. They're clearly sick. There's something wrong with them. It's possible that their organs, not to get graphic, but they literally slammed against different parts of their body and they're bleeding internally. So wow. I guess what I'm saying is if there is some sort of compression device, an explosion, and you don't think someone is severely injured because you don't see any outward display yet, you know in your head there's something really wrong with this person. You have to think about the internals. Once again, the destination is the key. So you can't do anything with that outside of the hospital. So they have to get to the hospital. And I just want to make one follow-up comment to Dave's discussion about law enforcement. In the 15 years I've been doing this, and I've participated in a lot of training with police officers in conjunction with law enforcement, there has been a marked shift in culture with police now understanding the need to treat and remove as they're advancing on this bad person. So whereas wow. a few of the initial wow. cops will go in and chase the bad person, the trailing police officers are getting much more adept at trying to treat very quickly and getting these people out. And on several recent training events I've been on, the evacuation time of these victims, especially if it's in an inside, it's in a building, is cut in half now that police are actually starting to wow. bring people out. And that never was the case a decade ago. It just wasn't.
Wow. Doc, you know, I've got to ask you this question because at different times, different things are said. But, you know, you hear, oh, don't move an injured person because you may cause them to be more injured. What's your expert advice on that?
Sure. So if there is a violent threat, that goes out the window. We don't care about the potential neck injury. We want someone and that person helping to be moved to a position of safety as quickly as possible, and they need to come to the hospital. You know, unfortunately, if someone has a neck or a back injury, they could have paralysis. But if you don't get them to a hospital, you won't know the difference. It doesn't matter because they'll be dead. So if it's a car crash and there's multiple victims and everything is safe, the scene is safe, there's no more moving vehicles, you don't have to move that person. You can wait till the medical professionals get there. In events like Boston and Highland Park, that's out the window. You get the patient to safety, you move them if you have to.
Wow, that's such good advice. And let me ask you, the theme of kind of what we do in preparing people, we used to say in the Secret Service that you rise or fall to the level of your training and preparedness in a crisis. And obviously, the pre-incident training is huge. Yeah. The pre-incident preparation, equipment, tourniquets, all those kinds of things. What would you say to an average family that is like, hey, you know, I'm not going to be paranoid, but I do want to be prepared. What would you say to them? Hey, you need this training and you need this equipment just because it may happen. And if it does happen, you'll be at least somewhat prepared for it.
Sure. You know, it's hard to advise people to, you know, carry a fanny pack with equipment on them if someone is so inclined, like you mentioned, tourniquets, gauze. Those are, you know, you don't need a whole lot else because bleeding is the only thing you really have to worry about. So if someone's bleeding from an extremity, tourniquet. If they're bleeding from anywhere else, it's pressure. There's nothing else you can do as a lay provider. You know, as a global preparatory tactic, and I learned this from Dave, and I sadly have to describe this to my kids now. When you're in a setting where there could be something bad that happens, you have to know where your exits are, and you just have situational awareness. You kind of have to have your head on a swivel. I'd send my daughters to, you know, concerts, both indoor and outdoor, and I sadly have to tell them, listen, you walk into this place, I want you to have fun. You have to know where your exits are. You have to just be prepared. It's the way of the world now, unfortunately.
You know, Doc, that's so huge, and Dave's heard this preached at nausea, but I'm going to do it again. The single greatest enemy to your security is right here. Because if you've got your head down, you're never going to see it, and it's going to happen just like that.
Right.
And I think at the end of the day, for all of us, we have to start thinking, like you said. We had Dave Adler on, who's on our team, and incredible. He's been an emergency incident manager in Illinois, just really sharp. And he said a statistic that shocked me, that if when you go into a restaurant building, whatever, you identify a second exit, not just the one you came in, but a second one. If there's a crisis, your chances for survival go up 80%. And when I heard that, I thought, wow, it doesn't get any better in terms of situational awareness, that when you walk into a place that you know exactly where the exits are. So when it, if it does go down, you're able to get yourself and your family out. And yeah. I'll tell you, this has been a fantastic discussion. Dave, any closing shots or any thoughts?
No, I definitely defer to the doctor.
Yeah. He's pretty smart, like you said he was. Well, folks, I hope this has been helpful for you. But guess what? It means nothing unless you say, you know what? I am going to be prepared. Let me just encourage you. Go to stopthebleed.org. They make packets, little packets. By the way, I carry a full medical kit in my car. Just because I want to be prepared. The other thing is CPR. If you don't know how to do CPR, you need to get CPR training. If you don't have basic first aid, get basic first aid training. But because here's the point. The days of waiting, like Doc said, oh, well, I hope they get here quick. I hope they make it in time. Those are gone. Wave goodbye to them. You need to be prepared to save yourself and your family. And I love what Doc said about Highland Park, that there were people, good people, who knew they were going into harm's way to save others. Some they didn't even know. And you know what? That just warms my heart, because in a world full of bad news, it's great to know. And so let me challenge you as we wrap this up, be that person that is prepared to save yourself, your family, and others. You will never regret it. So, guys, thank you for your time today. It has been fantastic. Doc, I'm going to pull you back if you'll come. Dave, you don't have a choice. You're stuck. But thank you both for sharing. You're both so experienced and humble. And I know many out there are going to really benefit from this. So thank you for all you're doing. And for everybody out there, stay safe.